I'm Tanya Mosley, and I want to thank you for listening to the Here and Now podcast. I also want to ask you to do something. Support your NPR station with a donation right now at donate.npr.org/now. Your contribution supports the reporting you hear every day, the latest from Washington, where a new administration is preparing to take over, and reporting from across the country on the surge of COVID-19 cases. Your donation ensures that you're hearing a range of voices, the experts, and also the everyday people who are experiencing all of this right now, like we all are. You're also helping to make possible those unforgettable interviews with authors, big thinkers, and creatives in the fine arts and popular culture. Those moments that make you want to listen every day. So make a donation to your NPR station now. Your contribution is more important than ever. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now let's get to the news.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. And this next story is a reminder that sometimes truth is stranger than fiction. A Russian spy unwittingly revealed how Russian agents nearly killed opposition leader Alexei Navalny back in August when they placed the lethal nerve agent Novichok inside Navalny's underpants. Even stranger, the spy disclosed that detail to Navalny himself, who was impersonating a high-ranking Russian official on the phone. CNN's Clarissa Ward broke this story in collaboration with the investigative outlet Bellingcat and Der Spiegel, and she joins us via Skype. Clarissa, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on, Peter.
And let's start with a little more context here. Back in August, Navalny was flying to Moscow from the city of Tomsk when he became very ill on the airplane. And here he is recounting that moment to you. Let's listen.
I get out of this bathroom, turn over to the flight attendant and said him, I was poisoned, I'm going to die. And then I lay down under his feet and to die.
So the pilot then diverted the plane to the Russian city of Omsk. Navalny survived. He's now in Germany. But tell us what you learned about the days and hours leading up to that moment on the airplane.
I mean, you know, it's just been extraordinary to get this kind of insight into how an elite team of FSB, Russian State Security Service operatives, with a specialty in chemical weapons, many of them doctors, scientists, operating out of a unremarkable Moscow suburb, were able to essentially trail Navalny's every move for more than 3 years. Then, as you said, in August, Navalny became very sick on the way back from Tomsk on this flight. And the Germans, once he was able to be transported to Germany, confirmed that he had been poisoned with Novichok. We now know that that Novichok was planted in Navalny's underpants, if you can believe that.
Wow. What does that detail say to you?
So we spoke to a lot of experts about this to try to understand it better, both from the point of view of understanding whether the intention was to kill or possibly just to incapacitate. And by the way, all of them agree you can only really be looking to kill when you're using Novichok outside of a laboratory, but also to get a better sense of why would they put Novichok in the underpants? And particularly, this one operative describes in this now famous phone call to Alexei Navalny, where Navalny was posing as a senior national security aide conducting an investigation into the operation. He tells him, listen, we put it on the underwear, on the inside seams of the crotch area. And experts have told us that the groin area is particularly porous, particularly susceptible to this kind of poisoning.
So they certainly knew what they were doing. And as you say, it was Navalny himself who was able to coax these details out of this agent who was a part of this toxins team. Why did Navalny do that? How did Navalny do that?
So when I was in Moscow last week with my team, we all set about trying to confront some of the people that through this investigation with Bellingcat, we have been able to identify as part of this FSB toxins team. Then they landed on this idea of pretending to be someone high up within the Russian hierarchy. And they were able to disguise the phone number they were using to make it look like they were calling from an FSB landline. And if you listen to the conversation, it's something like 45 minutes long. It does take a while to persuade this operative. His name is Konstantin Kudryavtsev. He graduated from the Russian Academy of Chemical Defense. It does take him a while to be persuaded that it's okay for him to have this conversation on an open line with Navalny. But once he starts talking, boy, does he start talking.
Wow. Vladimir Putin himself has said that if his agents wanted to kill Navalny, they would have done it. So what do you make of that? A reaction in Russia about how high up this operation went in the government?
Well, I mean, this puts the Kremlin in an extraordinarily embarrassing and uncomfortable position, because just last week, President Putin, responding to our reporting, said, "What's the big deal? So what? The FSB were following Navalny. That's normal because he works with U.S. intelligence services. That doesn't mean they poisoned him." Well, fast forward just a few days, and here we are with concrete evidence that, in fact, that team of operatives who were following him did poison him. And so how on earth does the Kremlin go about wriggling out of this one, essentially? I will say that unlike last week, where it was much more silent in the Russian media and people weren't really talking about it, perhaps because they were fearful, this time people are starting to talk about it. We've already seen Russian journalists trying to go to the address of this Kudryavtsev, this operative who unwittingly confessed to Alexei Navalny. And I think it's going to be very difficult for the Russian government to put this genie back in the bottle.
And just briefly, Clarissa, it is amazing to see you sitting there in front of Alexei Navalny, who had gone through such a tremendously traumatic ordeal on this airplane, getting poisoned. He's been a thorn in the side of Vladimir Putin for many years. It's amazing that he's still alive. How is his health? How's he doing?
He has made nothing short of a miraculous recovery, and all of his doctors say the same thing. What is even more extraordinary is that Alexei Navalny is still planning to go back to Russia. He says he's a Russian politician, he belongs in Russia, and he would never give Putin such a gift, he said, as to stay outside of his country.
CNN's Clarissa Ward reported this story along with the investigative outlet Bellingcat and Der Spiegel in Germany. Clarissa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Quite something. Let's get the latest on coronavirus vaccines. Today, the European Union gave the green light to the Pfizer and BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine already in use in the U.S., and Americans are expected to start receiving an additional vaccine from Moderna. So far in the U.S., the only people to get vaccinated outside of clinical trials have been prominent politicians, healthcare workers, and some residents of long-term care facilities. But yesterday, the CDC panel recommended that Americans at least 75 years old and frontline essential workers be next in line. So let's take a look with Dr. Amish Adolja, a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health and Security. Dr. Adolja, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So this week, the nursing home program will begin to roll out with help from CVS and Walgreens going into nursing homes. It's formally called the Long-Term Care Vaccination Program. But we're reading reports that some nursing home staff say they're skeptical of the vaccine. They might not get it. Now, we've explored the reasons here. Many think it's been politicized. Many of color have an understandable distrust of the medical world. But do you think in order for this to work, that at some point staff of nursing homes going to have to be required to be vaccinated?
It's going to be hard to require something that's only available as an emergency use authorization. We do require, for example, many places require flu vaccine as a condition of employment, but that is a vaccine that has a full FDA licensure. So I think that right now the goal is going to try to be to persuade people, incentivize people, really encourage them, especially healthcare workers, and especially those in long-term care facilities where there is an extremely vulnerable population, to have as high a vaccine uptake as possible. And we have to be very aggressive and proactive about this. And you have to remember that just because people are healthcare workers doesn't mean they're not impacted by the vaccine hesitancy and the anti-vaccine movement. I've heard people in the hospitals that I work in saying atrocious things about these vaccines that are completely not true. And these are all professional licensed healthcare workers. So this is a challenge, and we need as many healthcare workers as possible to be vaccinated so that we can take care of these patients safely and move forward in this pandemic.
That's so chilling that you're even hearing it in hospitals. Well, over the weekend, Army General Gustav Perna apologized for what he said was his error in estimating how many doses the government would actually be able to clear for shipment. And that, we remember, led to some states having to cut back on what they thought they'd get and how many people they'd be able to vaccinate. Give us a sense of the logistical challenges we're facing trying to distribute these vaccines.
it's probably the biggest public health endeavor that we've ever undertaken as a country. Nothing really comes this close, not even seasonal flu or the 2009 H1N1 pandemic vaccine. And there's going to be hiccups. There's going to be logistical problems, especially when you're talking about a vaccine, the Pfizer vaccine, that requires an extremely tenuous cold chain where you cannot allow the virus, the vaccine to develop, to kind of have a higher temperature, because that makes the vaccine unviable. That's posed a lot of challenges, and we've been meeting them so far, but it is something that I think we have to expect is not going to go off completely without a hitch. And so far, I think things have gone okay. I got my vaccine on Friday without any problem, but it's something that I think we're going to have to get used to as we go through the rollout of this vaccine, that there are going to be differences in estimates. And I think what happened with General Perna is there's a bureaucratic issue of how quickly something can ship when it's cleared for shipment based on FDA regulations and the like. And I think that type of bureaucracy is causing delays. And, none of us really expected that it would go off completely without any kind of delays or overestimations or underestimations. But I think, I think they're doing the best they can. And Operation Warp Speed is one bright spot in a really flawed pandemic response that we've seen. So I do think this is something that we are going to see, and we have to get used to hearing about that.
Well, doctor, we've only got a minute, and you are a doctor, and we've got Christmas coming, and experts saying it's going to take to 2021 for a significant portion of Americans to be inoculated. So talk to people. What should they know?
You have to know that these vaccines are lights at the end of the tunnel, but we're still in a tunnel, and there are many people that are going to get infected, that are going to get hospitalized and die from this virus before the vaccine is available to the general public. So we have to start behaving as if we're in a pandemic. And that doesn't mean that you completely socially isolate yourself. It means that you start to think about making risk calculations when you take any activity, trying to follow the common sense recommendations of wearing a face covering, washing your hands, trying to avoid crowded and congregated places. Just try to reduce the harm that this virus is causing.
Yeah. Dr. Amish Adalja, senior scholar at Johns Hopkins, thank you so much.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. For more than a century, a resilient city and region have relied on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve our most serious problems. The Foundation's work has been strengthened by hundreds of people who've left legacies to support our community. Leaving a charitable legacy at the Boston Foundation is a great way to have an impact now and in the future. Learn more at tbf.org/partner.
The rebuilding of the 850-year-old Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris is entering a new phase. The cathedral's massive organ has been completely disassembled ahead of schedule for cleaning, and workers have removed construction scaffolding that melted during the catastrophic fire last year. Vivian Walt is a Time magazine correspondent who's been following the renovations, and she joins us now from Paris. Vivian, welcome. Good to speak with you.
Thank you for having me.
And what about that scaffolding? It had been on the cathedral even before the fire broke out, and some people thought that maybe it was keeping the building from actually falling down. Now that it's gone, how much of a milestone was that in the process?
Now that they've got that off the roof, they've now begun to construct scaffolding inside the cathedral, and remarkably, they've able to get up to the vault level perhaps for the first time in hundreds of years. No one had actually seen the top of this cathedral close up until now. So the fire, ironically, as tragic as it was, has become an absolute lesson for a whole range of different artisans, scholars. They only just discovered that the two sides of the cathedral, which they didn't know, were not entirely symmetrical, that there were parts of the cathedral that were slightly wider than other parts.
Wow. I know the issue of lead has been very important because the lead roof melted in the fire. Lead dust coated not only the rubble of the building, but the entire area. Do researchers now have a better idea just how much contamination there has been?
Well, they believe there has been a lot of contamination inside the cathedral. And in fact, the few times that I have been inside Notre Dame since the fire, we've had to dress completely in like hazmat suits and shower on our way out. Every single thing that touches the cathedral cannot be taken back out on the street. So they're very, very serious about the lead pollution. The whole area around what is the oldest part of Paris has been quite badly affected. The buildings, the schools, everything needed to be decontaminated.
You mentioned being inside the cathedral with that, you know, for lack of a better word, a hazmat suit. What is it like? This is one of the most monumental places of worship in the world. Reduced to this, what's it like inside?
You know, it is really strange, Peter, because, of course, I have been in Notre Dame many times, and it's always a very kind of cavernous, dark, almost gloomy place inside. And, of course, it's always crowded with tourists. 14 million tourists visit every year. And now it is echoing and empty. And it's also without a roof. So you have this immense amount of sunlight pouring into this enormous space. And you walk around and it's just utterly awe-inspiring and also a little kind of devastated feeling. It does feel a little bit like, you know, some, you know, war-damaged building, for example. Now, the architects are very keen to point out that it looks a lot worse than it is. Of course, they lost the incredible 300-foot spire. They lost the roof, which is enormous, and they lost much of the old medieval oak vault that covered the ceiling. But aside from that, things were pretty much intact. And wow. Once they can start rebuilding the top of the cathedral, they should be on their way.
So that leads me to the next question. Now what? As you well know, President Macron had somewhat controversially said that the cathedral would be rebuilt within 5 years. So what's next, and is he on track to make that goal?
Well, it sounded so ambitious at the time, and it was a promise that he made the morning after the fire when everybody was in shock. And I think it was his way of saying, you know, we have to have hope and this will be okay. And in retrospect, I think it was the best thing he could have done because it gave people a very limited time period in which to sort out some very key controversial issues. For example, would they do something modern and innovative in rebuilding the cathedral? That whole controversy has now been settled. Macron announced during the summer that things would be built exactly as they had been. The first mass in Notre Dame will be held, they think, April 15th, 2024, which will be 5 years, the fifth anniversary of the fire. It will also, very interestingly, be in the middle of Macron's re-election campaign. And it will also be a few months before the Paris Olympics are held. It probably will take some time before you see 14 million tourists traipsing through there every year.
Well, Vivian, can you, you know, we're heading towards the Christmas season here. It would normally be a very important time for this cathedral. You know, how are people feeling going into the end of this very difficult year?
One really great thing that Notre Dame has been able to do is they've organized for the choir, the famous Notre Dame choir, to sing inside the cathedral just before Christmas. And it will be live streamed on French television. And it's very much aimed at getting people to feel a sense of upliftment after what's been a very grueling year for the city and for the world. And in some ways, the beginning of a sense of healing.
Vivian Walt, Time magazine correspondent in Paris, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And here is the Notre Dame choir and congregation singing "O Come All Ye Faithful" during a Christmas Mass in 2016. Well, French officials are considering cleaning the inside surfaces of the cathedral with one of the newest technologies in art restoration, lasers. An art restoration expert from Chicago invented the technique, and it's already been tested inside Notre Dame. Bartek Dynovsky is president of GC Laser Systems. Bartek, welcome. You were in the cathedral just last month testing different settings of your lasers. How do they work? Give us the layman's version.
Sure. So the technology is both very simple in concept and also quite complicated. Just has to do with the fact that light absorbs into materials differently. And what we do is we calibrate our laser technology to excite the layer of contamination with laser pulses. And when that contamination gets hit by a laser pulse, the molecules get so excited by the energy they absorb, they literally shake themselves apart and just vaporize off the surface. So
wow,
we get it to separate without any use of chemicals, without any mechanical abrasion. And then we have a method of capturing everything. We actually have a new patent-pending fume capture system that guarantees that all of the material is 100% captured.
Okay, so capturing the soot and the lead that comes off these walls is important. But how big is the job? Is it just entirely covered in soot and lead dust? I mean, do you have to clean up the entire building?
Well, during the process of our testing, we were literally working from the very bottom to the very top in different areas.
Wow.
There is a lot of soot throughout, but they've already made great progress with the general cleanup and stabilization of everything. There's also things that weren't a result of the fire, just regular, you know, grime and, for example, candle soot in some areas, right? So the level of cleaning is important to always keep in mind when we're dealing with conservation and restoration, because we, in some cases, don't want to make things look brand new.
Right.
So another advantage is that we can actually control how much we remove and how clean we make things look with different settings of the laser, so we can control how much we're taking off.
Well, that is interesting. Now, your technology has cleaned the facade of the U.S. Supreme Court building and the lions in front of the New York Public Library. What do you think, when you're done here inside the cathedral? Now, you said you don't want it to look like it was freshly built in 2020 or 2021, but what will it look like? Do you think it'll be close to the way it was before the fire broke out?
I think the aesthetics and the overall intent and experience of it should be the same or very similar.
Hmm. We heard Vivian Walt of Time Magazine describe what it was like to be inside the building. What about for you? What's that experience like to be in such an important building that has been so badly damaged?
Well, for me, this building is very important, not just because it's such a cultural icon, but my father took me there when I was a boy and was showing me the gargoyles. And when I saw the cathedral burning, one of the thoughts I had, I was really worried, like, that might not be an experience I get to share with my sons. Actually being inside, it's a surreal feeling. You know, you realize the scope of what is in front of you and what has to be done. But on a professional level, it's not an impossible task to accomplish.
Are you a religious person?
I am, yes. I'm Catholic.
Yeah, so that might add an extra layer of complexity. Did the building retain its spiritual power when you were inside?
Inside, honestly, I had a feeling of hope as soon as I walked in. And I'm not worried about it being brought back to its former glory.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people are glad to hear you say that. Art restoration expert Bartek Dynofsky, president of GC Laser System. His laser cleaning technology has been approved for use inside the cathedral by the French government. Bartek, thank you.
Thank you.
Many Americans could soon receive another direct payment from the federal government as part of a new pandemic relief package. If Congress passes the bill later today, as expected, the Treasury Department will send out $600 checks to those who qualify. Let's bring in personal finance expert Jill Schlesinger. She's CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Hey, Jill.
Good morning, good afternoon, whatever it is. I don't even know what time it is.
Whatever it is, I don't even know. Anyways, this is big news for a lot of people who are struggling. What do we need to know about who's going to get this money and how much it will be?
Well, like the last stimulus checks, those were for $1,200. This $600 is income tested. So if you have income less than $75,000 as an individual, $150,000 if you're married filing jointly, you'll qualify. And what is income? Income can be wages. It can be Social Security. It could be pension. In addition, if you still meet those thresholds, you will get $600 per child under the age of 17. Sorry for the college-age parents out there. The amounts phase out, the $600 for the big check, the $600 for kids. It starts to phase out until you reach $99,000 as an individual, $198,000 married filing jointly.
And how quickly will this happen? Because as you well know, many people are hungry, standing in line for food. They're struggling to pay bills, facing eviction.
Well, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin has said that the government could send this money out as soon as the beginning of next week. So that's amazing. But there's a real kind of an asterisk with that, because remember last time these checks were going out, it was predicated on people who filed their taxes electronically. So if you had paper returns filed either for 2018, 19, even this year, it's going to take longer. I suspect it'll be a couple of months before everyone gets on board and gets these checks.
Well, everyone's situation is so different. Jill, you and I have spoken many times in this segment about how white-collar workers in this economy are doing fine. In fact, maybe they're even doing better. Those people may be able to give their checks away if they need to. But what's your advice on the best way for people to spend that money as it comes in?
Well, I think that this is all about financial triage, right? And as you said, there are some people who will not need this money. You're lucky, you're fortunate, that's great. Let's put those aside for a second. For everyone else, this is about what do you need to do to conserve this money? And by the way, $600 doesn't sound like all that much, but if you have a few kids, could be a couple thousand dollars. You want to try to replenish your savings, which many people have plowed through. And we're trying to get people to get 6 to 12 months of their living expenses. Maybe if that's already done, maybe you've got a nice nest egg set aside. Maybe it's paying down some debt, some credit card debt, an auto loan here or there. And if you are really in this great place where you've got your emergency funded, you've got the debt paid down, maybe it's time to put some money away in retirement. Maybe there's a Roth IRA in your future. But it, as you said, very much dependent on your situation.
And just briefly, Jill, will it be enough, that $600, enough to prop up the economy?
You know, I think the combination of having $900 billion and the force of all of that, to whether it's small business, whether it is for vaccines and schools, the combined output is going to be better, right? But is it enough to kind of get us through these dark months of the winter where the virus is surging and people are really afraid? We don't know yet. It's certainly better than zero, which is where we were looking at a few weeks ago.
No doubt about that. Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Thank you so much.
Great to be with you, Peter.
The New York Times reports that last Friday, President Trump met with his former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn about something Flynn has called for, invoking martial law, the military, to rerun the election. Now, Trump later denied the talk, but our next guest says Joe Biden will enter office with more challenges than any president since Lincoln, including an erosion of trust in institutions like elections by Trump, a pandemic, and a kneecapped economy. But as James Fallows asks historians and lawyers of both parties for his article in The Atlantic, should Biden take time to investigate Trump? The answer was yes, in three areas, and as to how, with commissions. James Fallows, welcome back.
Robin, thanks so much.
Before we get to those three things that these experts told you should be investigated, Donald Trump is unprecedented, the only president to never have an approval rating over 50%, the only modern administration to have seven close friends or officials indicted, tried, convicted, jailed, or all of them. Nonprofits have cataloged over 3,000 instances of conflict of interest by Trump or his family. Tell us a little bit about this debate as to whether or not Biden should investigate. There are people who say, just move on. There's too much to do. Don't create more divisiveness. But you spoke to Sam Berger of the Center for the American Progress. What case did he make?
So the case that he made, a number of other people, including Julian Zelizer and Mr. Cruz of Princeton, is that the cost of not having accountability is too great to ignore, that if norms are not reestablished, if people are not held to some kind of liability for things they either did or tolerated, then the long-term historical consequences of ignoring or papering over history are too serious. And you can think of examples from all around the world of countries that either have or have not coped with the difficult moments in their history. The challenge for Biden is there are so many things that have to be done. You don't want to be too weighed down with the past. And that is particularly a challenge for him now because there is so much in the immediate past and there's so much in the immediate future.
Well, and many told you the best thing he can do, Joe Biden, is get out of the way of needed inquiries. But everyone you talked to said the job is to triage. And there are two things he has to be involved in. First, stemming the corrosion of the executive branch.
We take for granted that there are all these operating parts of the government in scientific realms, in public health, in the weather service, in lots of invisible parts of what's often referred to dismissively as the bureaucracy, on which modern life actually depends. And those parts of the government have been, lots of people have left, many people have been fired, young people have been discouraged from joining the State Department or the Voice of America. So this is something where a new president has a lot of control over the people he can directly name to executive branches in the government and the example and message he can send about why public service is important.
You went on to say there's both corrosion and corruption. And you say there might be possible violations of federal law. What happened at the Postal Service? What was the role of Attorney General William Barr? What's the number one thing a President Biden should do with those questions?
In federal cases, the most important thing that a Biden administration can do is make sure that its attorney general is an eminent, respectable, nonpartisan figure, and leaving that attorney general and the inspectors general at executive departments say, we trust you to do the right thing. Go and do that, and don't tell me about it until I see it in the papers.
Yeah, don't tell me about it. So that brings us to the second thing that just about everyone told you that a President Biden should do, which is launching but not running independent investigations into three national catastrophes: the mismanagement of the pandemic, the border policies that separated children from their parents, and President Trump's destruction of the norms of government, the most important being challenging a legitimate result of an election he lost. The pandemic. Others can investigate what went wrong, and you say should. But you talked to historian Philip Zelikow, and he said Biden's job will be the narrative. Now, obviously, we're not going to hear anymore that the virus is a hoax or it's just going to go away. There won't be a radiologist telling us falsely that hydroxychloroquine works. But what else do you mean about Biden's narrative?
So the point that Philip Zelikow was making about commissions and their role in American history is they can change the story of how we understand traumas we've been through or challenges we have. You can think back to the Space Shuttle Commission, the way that Richard Feynman, the famed physicist, was leading inquiries on what had gone wrong within NASA to allow that to happen. The 9/11 Commission and where the U.S. government had failed in preparing. The Kerner Commission in the 1960s on racial injustice in American cities. And all of them had some effect on how the political system and the news system and citizens thought about what had happened and what they should do. I think when it comes to the horror of this pandemic, which in my view has been the greatest failure of governance in federal history, the idea will be, how can we prevent this from happening again?
Your second thought for an independent investigation is into the separation of children from families on the border. Now, this was heartbreaking. And then there was a list of 600 children whose parents couldn't be found. It just disastrous. But really, you would, and these that you spoke to, would place this as the second problem Biden should attack.
Yes, for these two reasons. One, I quote a man named John Allen, a retired four-star Marine Corps general who now heads the Brookings Institution, saying that state-sponsored separation of children from their parents has cast the United States in a sort of permanently shamed position in the eyes of the world. And that because this was done in the name of the state needs to take some responsibility for these families too. But then more broadly, immigration policy is central to American identity, and this act of family separation is something that needs to be accounted for.
Yeah. And investigate the purposeful or negligent mismanagement of the government. Just what do you mean there?
The mechanics that make democracy possible, allowing people to vote, having forums for discourse, protecting people from political violence, all of the plumbing that makes democracy possible, that was in a way the center of the 1960s legislation, the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. And there seemed to have been either a casual or intentional efforts to limit the franchise in recent years. And so trying to find ways to make democracy function in a way that is not partisan but is profoundly American also seems to warrant proper recommendations of what is the right path forward for the country.
Like putting people who have expertise in a certain job into those jobs.
That would be one illustration.
I want to stay, though, with this notion of a commission, that's, you know, what people suggest as a solution. And you have mentioned very noble commissions in American history, the Warren Commission, you know, on the assassination of JFK. But there are still people who don't believe the results of that commission. There are still people who don't believe the Kerner Commission, which pointed out, you know, the poverty, the inequity in inner cities that was causing riots in the 60s. And now you have complete parallel realities that are supported much more widely and much more above ground than then. You've got the Republican Ron Johnson holding hearings into election fraud. He would say for the same reason you've just outlined commissions, that it's because people believe there's fraud, so we have to find out. But people believe there's fraud because people like Ron Johnson and President Trump tell them there's fraud. It's a closed loop. So what do you say to people who, when you say commissions, they yawn?
Yes, any sensible person does yawn at the word commissions, including me. This sounds boring, but we live in a fallen world. And if you think of the alternative ways of trying to process what has happened and what to do about it, congressional hearings, you know, that's just a way where Congress people get their 2 or 3 minutes on TV and senators bloviate. That criminal investigations of these sorts of matters have their limits, as we saw with the Mueller investigation. It was narrowly criminal, and there are lots of things that it ruled out. And there is enough of a better track record of trying to assemble public-minded officials, of which you can find some in elected office, and say, you have a charge to try to tell us how we should think about problems in our past and prospects for our future. And that's the best of the limited options we have for trying to reset some shared public narrative. This seems like one possible path forward when we see steps towards the abyss on every other point of the compass.
James Fallows, staff writer for The Atlantic, and we'll link you to his new piece, How Biden Should Investigate Trump, at hereandnow.org. Jim, thanks so much.
Robin, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Farm workers in Monterey County, California, are three times more likely to get the coronavirus than other workers. Many live in communal housing where the virus can spread quickly with catastrophic consequences. So now, some farmers are offering sick or exposed workers a hotel room, medical care, and food while they ride out the disease in isolation. Already on the farms around Salinas, more than 400 workers have used the program, which is being replicated in other states. Christopher Valadez is president of the Grower Shipper Association of Central California. Christopher, welcome. How does this work?
Yes, so you pretty much hit it on the nose. It's for members of the ag employee community who have either tested positive or were exposed. And in either case, because of maybe their own personal living conditions, which may not allow them to isolate or quarantine safely, we've provided an option free of charge to them to be able to take access to quality housing for at least a 2-week period of time to help them out through that period, providing meals daily, 3 meals a day, in addition to any other snacks or items needed for comfort or just to try to bring the familiarity of home to them. And in addition, here in the Salinas Valley, we partnered with the Salinas Valley Memorial Hospital. And so through them and their team of nurses, they've made contact with everyone who's been enrolled in the program multiple times a day just to check in on them, provide whatever services they can to help people along through their dealing with COVID-19.
One of the things I'm guessing a lot of people don't realize is that a farm worker in Salinas, when that growing season is over, will then move to other places across the country. They might come down to the Yuma, Arizona area or Imperial County in California nearby. And that's how I heard about what you're doing, because I was in Yuma and that's where the bulk of the U.S. lettuce supply is grown in the winter. And I heard that the county was preparing to do that last month to work on a program like this as the season picked up. So have you seen interest in what you're doing expand as people move with the seasons?
I have. Our employers here, many of them produce elsewhere, inclusive of Yuma. We were able to help them by expanding our program and duplicating it in other regions, namely in Yuma. And so we've had our Yuma housing operation, which operates nearly identical to the one we've been operating here now in the Salinas Valley since April. Our Yuma one started in November, has been up and running since that point.
One thing I want to ask you real quick before I let you go, the vaccine is out. Essential workers, hospitals, doctors, nurses, they're getting it. Could you make the argument, would you make the argument that farm workers should be close to the front of the line when it comes to getting that vaccine? Because if there's one thing we've learned during this pandemic, it's that if the agriculture workers are sick, food production can stop.
To your questions, both should and would. Undoubtedly, yes. I think in order to ensure the continuity of the food production system and food security, you have to have, you know, the available labor supply. And so for us, I think, you know, there is no question that given the impacts onto the farm worker community and given their importance on, I would call, a national scale, not just here in California or in Yuma, but a national scale to continue to provide and be that backbone, we should and must prioritize farm workers for receiving the vaccine.
Have you made any progress getting those workers moved up to the front of the line?
So in California, they have identified farm workers within this 1B tier. So 1B is, as I understand, this kind of secondary tier still within this range of one. So that's good news. The challenges that we are trying to work through, and it's really one of understanding, is what will distribution look like? I don't think we perceive that vaccine distribution is going to necessarily happen in a centralized fashion, particularly as it relates to a community that may just in general be hard to access, that may have acceptance or language barrier or a trust barrier with a service or a program, particularly from an actor or agent, if we're talking about a government institution, that right, they just might not have that type of familiarity with. And so for us on an operational scale, I foresee a need to be able to use the employer in the distribution model, you know, probably not too dissimilar from a, you know, a mobile lab that might show up or employer engages to do COVID-19 or a flu shot, something similar.
Do it on the farm.
Exactly. Something similar should be at play because we have to critically think about how we can best integrate the employer. At a minimum, while it's imperfect, it is a point of access for the delivery of this service. And in this case, you know, it's the vaccination of the farm worker community.
Christopher Valadez, president of the Grower Shipper Association of Central California, talking with us from Salinas, California. Christopher, thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate the time.
And when I was in Yuma back in early November, I reported that a significant COVID outbreak hadn't yet hit those farms. It was early in the season. Well, Christopher Valadez tells us that the program we've just been talking about has now served about 50 sick or exposed farm workers in that area. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now. Online scammers are taking advantage of the pandemic to sell puppies that don't exist, charging hundreds or thousands up front for the dogs that are never delivered. Next time, here and now.